Hi, this is Tamson Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
And we're here with Tamson and Dan Read the Paper. It's June 11th.
And we're just back from a trip.
Trip to Italy. Bike trip to Italy. Bike trip with Backroads.
That's right. We go every once in a while. I'd say about annually, we go on one organized bike trip with an organization, in this case Backroads, in which you explore a different part of the world. Several times we've been to Italy. In this case,
we went to Parma, Mantua, Verona.
And just to set the stage here, what I mean by a bike trip with an organization like Backroads is you sign up for a trip. There are 15 or 20 people. In this case, it was 24 people. You have leaders, you have support staff, they take all your stuff, they cater to you quite a bit. You spend a week on your bicycle. You're doing around 40 miles or even more each day, although there are a lot of options. Some bike more, some bike less. You get to see a lot of these places in Italy. You eat at some fine places, and you see a lot of things.
Yeah, yeah. And we're not intrepid travelers.
No.
And we're not super cyclists.
No, we're not super cyclists.
So Backroads is a great boon to us.
That's
because
right.
They put together this great itinerary, and somehow we manage.
That's right. And we need the support. So, you know, I think we're decent on the bicycle, but the fact of the matter is, if you're considering it, you shouldn't be put off if you don't feel that you're an advanced cyclist. Plenty of people take advantage of the options to take afternoons off, to ride a little less. On the other hand, others, including sometimes the other spouse, is riding like crazy and dialing up 70, 80 miles a day. There's a lot of flexibility there. But a big part of the trips for us is meeting the people.
Yeah, you meet all kinds of people. And this is fun. You talk to people. It really broadens your horizons. Sometimes in terms of the cycling, wouldn't you say? Sometimes you're inspired by other people's cycling.
Right.
Sometimes you're just amused by people.
Right. It's an interesting way.
Relationships.
Yeah. Right. You meet people in an interesting way. And it's worth mentioning because when I talk to people about these trips, the first thing they say to me, well, not the first. First thing they say is, what are you crazy? Why are you spending your week on a bicycle killing yourself? But the second thing they say is, aren't you taking an awful chance by signing up with a group of people who you don't know? And the truth is, you're not. We've done a bunch of these trips, more than 10. We never know the people we sign up with. You meet them the first day. As I said, they're 15 or 20 people. And they're always very nice people. And it always enriches your experience to be traveling with these folks.
Yeah, there's a social dynamic that really enhances the trip, I think.
Right.
So we had terrific leaders, Licia and Ksenia, and they really did a good job encouraging us, leading us through incredibly busy little towns
right.
and cities.
I will say
with Italian drivers.
That's right. It is funny because you get a lot of guidance and a lot of support, but on the other hand, the difference between a European trip and an American trip is the European trip will give you a chance to get yourself in trouble. But we managed to avoid that. What we like to do now, we spend a day in advance of the trip in Italy in this case, and day at the end. And in this case, we spent those days in Lido.
We flew into Venice. And then you get to the Lido, which is one of the islands of Venice, by boat.
Water bus. Because we wouldn't spring for the water taxi. Tamsin's very tight. But it turns out water bus.
Although water taxis are pretty cool.
Water taxis, they're like cigarette boats that fly across the
water. I mean,
water.
You saw pictures of them when George Clooney got married. They were all traveling by water taxis,
That's right.
looking very elegant.
That's right. We weren't meeting that standard. But the water buses is for the hoi polloi. And
it's about an hour by bus from the water bus. From the airport.
But here's the trick. The trick is when you're on the water bus, it's not like being a bus stuck in Midtown traffic. It's fun. It's part of the trip.
As a wise man once told us,
yes,
the trip is part of the vacation.
Yes, in this
so
case.
So you just relax and enjoy it. That's from
right.
Jared Harkham.
Right.
And so whenever.
Well, in this case, it really is.
It really was.
Usually
it
it's not. But in this case, you're on the water. You're looking out at Venice and all the waterways as you're traveling from one small town to the other. It's fantastic. It's totally scenic. It's a lovely way to travel. And of course, Italy is beautiful and has all the fine food. And for our purposes here, a lot of art. And Miss Granger here, of course, was drinking in all the art. And she can give you the highlights.
Yes. Yeah, so on this trip, I mean, one of the tricks is I don't think Dan would go on a vacation to look at art with me. I trick him into a vacation by telling him it's about biking. And then we accidentally end up in a few art situations.
Art situations would be an apt description.
So we did that. We actually went to Padua one day before the bike trip started. I sneaked him into Padua by way of water bus and several trains.
Yeah,
and, you know, before he knew it, he was in Padua at the Scriveni Chapel looking at frescoes by Giotto. And I love these frescoes. I've been teaching them for years. So to see them in person was breathtaking.
Yes, I will say that I won't name any piece of art or even try because I'll get it wrong. But clearly the highlight of this particular tour in this particular museum in Padua is you get to see this one large fresco and you're allowed to be in its
presence. Well, it's a chapel covered with frescoes.
Fair enough. My point is you get 15 minutes. You got 15 minutes in the room, and, you know, you might think it's too long. That's what I would think, but many people don't think it's enough time. But Tamsin Bolt's in there, and she's chattering away. And the only way Tamsin can enjoy this is to tell someone else about it, and that is usually me. So we walk
in. Yes, everyone else was edging away.
Exactly, edging, flying. They were in flight, and Tamsin grabs me and says, look at this, look at this, look at this. And, you know, and Tamsin's got a lot to say, and she has some very valid observations from my perspective in terms of the way they show three dimensions, the artistic approach that they take, you know, the images
it's
meant.
It's about the stories. It's about
the stories. And I will say, if you ever spend time with Ms. Granger, the more gross the story, the more detail you're apt to get from Tamsin on the story. There's no avoiding that. Let's not tell those stories here. But the fact is that Tamsin was in a whirlwind taking me on a tour around, you know, the fresco, which sort of the chapel. You were spinning around.
So that worked out. We got caught in a rainstorm in Padua.
Right.
But basically it was fun. But Padua, not the area we were in, not so beautiful, really. Heavily bombed during World War II by the Allies, actually. Right. And so they ended up with kind of a bleak, fascistic architecture to replace what was there. And not charming, shall we say.
Right.
But also, now on the bike trip, we went some interesting places, including a little town called Sabbioneta, which was actually sort of designed by one of the Gonzagas. The Gonzagas, leading family in Mantua. And so we're getting close to Mantua at this point.
And Gonzaga, by the way, just so you're clear, and you've made the connection already, the name of the school that went to the final of the NCAAs this year comes from the same Gonzaga.
Right, because one of the Gonzagas actually gives up all his money and joins the church. And actually, I think becomes a saint. So then he is promoted around the world in terms of learning, and etc.
And he's the namesake of the school.
Of many schools in the U.S., actually. Meanwhile, one of his ancestors, Vespasiano, in other words, Vespasian, Gonzaga, he's named after a Roman emperor, decides that he wants to recreate a Roman town in Italy. And so he builds basically a classical town, classical architecture, all the rage during this time, the second half of the 16th century. And he builds a wonderful little theater, and it's one of three Renaissance theaters still standing today in Italy. There's one in Parma and one up in Vicenza, designed by Palladio. It's Palladio who starts the ball rolling. Anyway, wonderful, interesting, fascinating theater called the Teatro all'Antica, meaning that it's designed in the classical, the ancient way, according to the precepts of theaters in Roman architecture. And on the outside, there is an inscription saying, Roma quanta fuit ipsa ruina docet. Mm-hmm. Basically saying we can see how great Rome was from its ruins. And this was actually, Gonzaga doesn't invent this saying. It actually comes from a guidebook.
All right.
From 1510, a guide called by Francesco Albertini was popular, telling you what to see in Rome, old and new. So he uses this on his theater. And, you know, it was a beautiful theater filled with actual, a wonderful series of sculptures of gods and goddesses. A little bit embarrassing. Couldn't stop myself.
Yeah, time's just going
had to correct the guide.
All right.
About which gods were which. But I am a little bit of a mythology geek. You know, I couldn't stop myself.
The real truth is, if you drop Tamsin in from a spaceship blindfolded in any chapel, based on her education and observation of patterns in other chapels, she'd start firing away about what's going on all around the interior, and she was in a rare form.
Interesting you're calling this a chapel, was a theater.
Oh.
But obviously, you understand that theater originated as a religious ritual dedicated to the god Bacchus, who was up there on the balcony as well.
Okay.
All right. And so then we also went to Mantua, and we had a nice walking tour provided by Backroads with a terrific guide, Lorenzo, who showed us around and showed us the great San Andrea Church by Alberti. Not to mention the fish market, and pointed out that Giulio Romano, who had been in Raphael's workshop, is a great painter and a great architect, and responsible for designing some of the actual infrastructure of Mantua.
Right, and what Tamsin had whispered to me just a few minutes before is what he's really most famous for is...
No, not everybody knows this.
Go ahead.
Is his pornography. Not that he actually didn't even realize how famous he was. Well, let's put it this way. He was commissioned by one of the Gonzagas to do a series of erotic paintings.
Yeah.
He was working on these paintings. Meanwhile, Marcantonio Antonio Raimondi, a famous engraver, printer of the period, puts together a series of engravings based on these paintings, and it's called I Modi. Pretty much could be translated as The Positions.
Ah.
And this book gets published as a book. Actually, Romano doesn't know anything about this. And Raimondi actually is sentenced to jail by the Pope for doing this, and he'll come back and do other editions. But meanwhile, someone else actually informs, lets Romano know about this. Romano doesn't go to jail for doing these same kinds of depictions. You know why? Because he's painting them for a private audience, not publishing it in a book.
All right.
Okay.
It's a legal point.
So, yeah.
All right. So the main...
I know you know you love the legal points.
But the main visit in Mantua...
was to the Palazzo Ducale, because I wanted to see some frescoes again. Right. The famous frescoes by Mantegna. Yes. And you were impressed by the trompe l'oeil of the ceiling.
Yes, the trompe l'oeil means, I think, correct me if I get this wrong, it looks three-dimensional, but it's not really...
It looks like it's all this fantastic stucco work and architectural detail, and it's just paint.
That's right.
And there's a famous hole in the ceiling starts the ball rolling for a lot of frescoes depict.
But the funniest thing to me was that at one point, you can start.
Well, there was something else I wanted to see
at
the Palazzo Ducale. And, you know, there was a poster on the outside mentioning the Studiolo of Isabella d'Este.
Right.
And
so Tamsin goes up to the guide. There's a woman who's working at the museum behind a desk who's studying or reading something, not paying much attention.
She's the monitor.
Exactly, monitor. Tamsin says,
the behavior monitor.
Can I see, the studio of Isabella? if I can
Isabella
quote.
D'Este. Isabella Studiolo is what I said to her. She didn't really understand any English.
She sits upright as soon as Tamsin says this. She doesn't merely direct Tamsin. She stands up and she doesn't speak English clearly, but she makes some
Wait a minute. She puts down her iPhone.
Puts down her iPhone, right?
And, but she closes what she's looking
at
on her computer.
And she's going to take us there. She's going to take us there. She's going to stop what she's doing and lead us. And she leads us along the corridor. We go around a bend.
And we pass another guard. And the guard looks at her and she just says,
and we have a
studio
space.
Low.
There's a space with a rope on it. The rope. She takes up the rope. We're going to go to the sacred place. We go up or down a staircase, I can't remember which, and we are taken to the studio.
To this little room.
We walk into the room, and the room is empty. And Tamsin looks at the room and pauses, then starts laughing. And the woman starts laughing. They're both laughing. They're having this great joke together. They don't speak the same language. And I have no idea what's going on. And it turns out that the big joke is,
the Gonzagas at a certain point need money. Everything's dismantled. It's in museums around the world.
Right.
What was in there decorating Isabella's studiolo. And I should just say what her studiolo was her little collection, her little private gallery of the best of the best of the artists and artifacts, ancient artifacts she collected.
But right now it's a private space roped off. That's basically an empty room. So that was another highlight, and that will give you a sense. I mean, I know that's a little more museum work than we usually provide in these podcasts.
But let's just also say we went to Verona. Verona has a very cool arena, huge arena that Adele performed in about a year ago.
Yeah, okay.
And they're having an opera festival there now, and they had this huge part of the set for Tosca and this huge arm sitting there on the ground.
The fact is, I think you're all getting a flavor of what it's like to be in Italy with Tamsin, and it's fun, but it's a fair dose. It's a fair dose of art, and yet we still had a very good time. And then we got on the plane just yesterday and headed back. So back to reality. Of course, the price you pay in going to Italy is the flight back is close to 9 hours.
And I know you watched a lot of movies.
I did what I could to pass the time. I did a fair bit of reading, too. But the truth is, while others I know talk about flights that are 12 hours, they go to New Zealand, it's even longer than that. To me, 9 hours is plenty. So when I come across a movie that's a good airplane movie, it's worth sharing. And The Founder is a good airplane movie. The Founder is the movie that was just released this past year with Michael Keaton playing Ray Kroc, the founder of McDonald's. And it didn't get that much play. It was just the timing was bad. I think 8 months ago it was thought of as a real Oscar contender, a major picture. The release was much awaited. And it just got overwhelmed by the other big pictures at the time. It never caught an audience, even though it had a very good review. And Keaton is extremely good as Ray Kroc. And it's one of those rare movies which is about business. You never see too many, you never see movies about business. I was telling Tamsin, there was the movie Joy that was about the person who was on the shopping network and sold products there. This was really how this person, Ray Kroc, developed a McDonald's idea, in particular, the franchising idea, and what went into that. And there's a lot of stuff in it that really rang true. Keaton's performance is great. It shows that, you know, to get something that big to succeed, you have an epiphany, and then you fail. And you have another epiphany. You got it. And then you fail. And then it takes about six epiphanies. You have to stick with it that long. It's issue after issue, it's insight after insight, and you stay with it. And look, one of the problems with the movie, I guess, for people watching it is that Ray Kroc is not a particularly likable guy. And at the end of the day, you're left with kind of a bad taste in your mouth about the whole thing.
But you enjoyed the movie.
But I did enjoy the movie. So, fast food like that just changed the culture. And it didn't happen by accident. There was a lot of planning and psychological
analysis.
But
it wasn't just about the food. I mean, that was the interesting thing about it. It was about real estate. It was about,
No, it wasn't about the food. That's not really about food. McDonald's is about manufacturing. And it's about the experience. And what kind of experience you're providing for people. And from a financial perspective, one of the big insights in the movie was at the beginning they weren't making as much money as they should have, and they talked to a financial analyst. They said, well, your mistake is this. You think you're in the hamburger business. You're in the real estate business. And what that meant was what they really had to do was own the land where the restaurants owned by the franchisees were sited. But in any event,
I actually have gotten on, before we leave movies,
yeah,
on the plane, I've gotten to the habit of watching foreign films.
Yeah.
Because so often I had bad headphones.
Yeah.
And so at least on foreign films, you have subtitles.
Right.
So you can read what you can't really understand.
That's fair.
So I saw a great Spanish film, The Illustrious Citizen. And then because I had actually bought better headphones, I was able to watch American movies as well.
Yeah.
And I watched Moana.
Oh, yeah. And you like that?
You know, it was kind of fun. Yeah. Anyway.
I didn't get the moment.
Moving back to food,
yeah,
and the subject of fast food, there was a fun article about a restaurant in Manhattan in the Wall Street Journal this weekend, a restaurant that is in the category of fast fine food.
Mm-hmm.
And this is food that is... high-end food, but it's produced quickly and fairly inexpensively. It's a restaurant you would go in, order at the counter, and then you sit down. The food is brought to you. But it's, it's more than just like Chopped or those places you go. It's a higher level, but more affordable. The restaurant they were talking about in this case is called Made Fine. And so... you get wine by the glass. You get, ambitious offerings, but without all the care and...
So it's really quick.
It's really quick, and there's not so much service. Is service.
All right, so
the food
funny.
Is brought to you. The wine is brought to you. It may be in a plastic cup.
Well, the funny thing about the founder is one of the breakthroughs was apparently in the 50s, what people really used to go to were these drive-ins, where you had the tray on the side of the car, and it took quite a long time to get your food and so on. When the first McDonald's opened up by these two brothers, and Ray Kroc visits it, it's just a guy selling milkshake machines, he doesn't even know enough to stand up and go to the counter because he thought you'd stay in your car. When he finally
gets come out.
The nerve to get to the counter, he says, here's my order. I'd like a hamburger, french fries, and a drink. They say 35 cents because it's 1954, and then they hand him a bag, and he says, well, what's this? And they said, what do you mean, what's this? He said, that's your order. He says, no, it can't be my order. I just gave you my order. They said, no, that's not the way it works.
That is fast. Yeah.
1954, that was a new thing. So now we see it going to fast food. And the big contrast between that is we went to some great restaurants in Italy, and perhaps one of the best ones, maybe the best, was one in Lido before we left, a place called La Favorita. And you need a reservation there. And it was a wonderful meal. But the point is...
it's not fast.
It's not fast.
No.
It's not fast. And what's interesting about that economically is it's tough to make money that way, quite clearly. And we had a 7:30 reservation. And, some of the Italians really take their time. We're not really pushing to take our time. We're not going to take a long time generally, but we were there until 10:30 because that's the way they do it with the various courses. They can't turn the table.
They're not turning the table.
They're not turning the table.
No.
So in an American restaurant that can turn tables, like the fast fine food or fine fast food, they got a chance to make more money. The Italians are not into that. They're in a different experience, and that's, of course, part of what going to Italy is all about.
Right.
Well, that's pretty interesting. Just a couple days after we left, I happened to notice on the wires that Jimmy Pearsall had passed away. Jimmy Pearsall was a baseball player who played for quite a long time, from 1952 to 1969, 17 seasons. And he was on the All-Star team a couple of times, which makes him a very good player, but not necessarily a major figure in the major leagues. But what made Jimmy Pearsall special was, as described at the time, he suffered from mental illness, which is the way they described it. What happened to Jimmy Pearsall was that he, in 1952, just shortly after he had gone up to the Boston Red Sox, he was engaging in various antics, the kind of things that were, seemed highly unusual to people at the time. And he was sent to a mental hospital for 6 weeks His mother had been in and out of mental hospitals, it turns out. In any event, he spent 6 weeks in a mental hospital, underwent shock therapy, had counseling for a nervous breakdown, and came back to the major leagues, where he spent another 16 seasons. But it was always characterized by what was considered unusual behavior. And Pearsall didn't really shy away from the idea that he engaged in unusual behavior. I recall 1963, when he was playing for the Mets and he hit his 100th home run, he ran around the bases backwards because he was celebrating the idea that he's kind of a nutty guy. And even on the publicity front, even more so, in 1957, there was a major motion picture about Jimmy Pearsall when he was a five-year veteran in the major leagues. He was still early in his career. A movie called Fear Strikes Out, in which Anthony Perkins played Jimmy Pearsall. Anthony Perkins, of course, famous for Psycho, which was made about the same time. And Anthony Perkins looked, you know, his manner, if you recall Anthony Perkins, always very anxious, very nervous. In this case, made very nervous by the fact that the second main character was his father, Carl Malden, who was an overbearing sports parent. He was on him all the time. And at least the way the movie played it, that's what caused his mental breakdown, which I should say was, he was eventually diagnosed to be a manic depressive. But Perkins looked terrible in baseball uniform. He looked awful. And he looked, I would say, you know, as you know, Tim, so when you bat right-handed, your right hand's on top. When you bat left-handed, your left hand's on top. Perkins looked like he was constantly trying to remind himself how that worked. And he looked more comfortable, I think, with the knife in Psycho than with the baseball bat in Fear Strikes Out. Pearsall didn't like the movie, oddly. He didn't like the movie for kind of a substantive reasons. He said there were events in the movie that never happened. He said, number two, and this is kind of an interesting thing, he said he never blamed his father for his mental breakdown. And you have to ask yourself, if he was manic depressive, does the fact that his father really pushed him to do baseball drills, did that cause him to be manic depressive? Mm-hmm. In the movie, that was the answer. Pearsall didn't see that connection. And number three, he thought Perkins looked terrible as a baseball player. So, Pearsall just didn't like the film at all, but it's kind of a very strange situation.
It was in the 50s?
Yeah, the movie was 1957.
Yeah, you can see how in the 50s there were probably very constrained ideas of what is normal behavior.
Right.
You know, not that he didn't struggle with his illness, but he wasn't necessarily completely constrained by that. Maybe in some ways it enhanced his
performance. Well, he's a remarkable character. He went with it. I mean, Pearsall became a public figure. He became a broadcaster.
Mm-hmm.
He spent years and years as a broadcaster. He lived to be 87. Mm-hmm. And he always did odd things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he said, yeah, that's me. And he called attention to it. And it's a very odd situation. But in any event, it's the beginning of, I think, a lot of sensibility to mental illness. And it's odd that there was a major movie about it in the late 50s. Maybe they didn't get it entirely right, but it's just remarkable that you had that kind of film.
All right. Well, where do we go from here? Back to the Wall Street Journal. And, of course, you know, as usual, still reeling from all the food and wine.
Right.
In Italy, I notice an article about wine and rosé, but not from Provence. It's an article embracing the possibilities of Spanish rosé.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently there are many affordable, delicious Spanish rosés, often not that pale, wonderful color of the Provençal rosés. Mm-hmm. So you shouldn't be turned off by this redder Spanish, but encouraging people to take a foray into Spanish rosé. So okay. I'm all for that. I'm on to that. I'm ready for that.
Glenn Headley died. Glenn Headley...
I'm not sure I know Glenn Headley, do I?
Glenn Headley was an actress known, I think, to most people Well, she was in television too. I don't want to speak for most people, but certainly known to me and to a lot of people for her role in Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. Dirty Rotten Scoundrels was a movie in 1988, which starred Steve Martin and Michael Caine when they were at the top of their game as comic actors. And what the story was, they were hustlers.
That's a little harsh, Daniel. That was a while ago.
They were at the top of
the game. Saying
that
about Steve Martin, 1988?
Yes, but I don't mean to be negative about what followed them. All I'm really saying, the point is this.
It's a terrific movie. You love the movie.
My point is that Glenn Headley steals the movie, which is an amazing thing. Because you have these two guys who are both gigolos, con men, whatever you want to call them. It's on the French Riviera. She is a woman with money who is unattached. They see that. They see her as someone who would be the subject of a swindle, whatever they would do to take away her money. They compete for her attention, and it's a comedy. And, you know, once in a while you hear people say someone steals a scene, steals a movie. This woman stole that movie, and she was hardly well-known at all. She had been an actress in Steppenwolf in Chicago. She had done theater. She was best known for being married to John Malkovich. It was her first major motion
picture.
But that's
not the only scene she stole.
She stole the whole movie.
No, but I mean that. But there's an interesting mention of a play.
Which play are we talking about?
Raul Julia.
With Raul Julia. Well, the same. She gets a great review later on in the play with Kevin Kline and Raul Julia, in which they say that she reduces both Mr. Kline and Mr. Julia to helpless tots. I mean, that's the quote from the Times reviewer. Glenn Headley was great.
Okay.
Glenn Headley was great.
Yeah.
And it's funny to me, you know, you hear people talk about movies like Bridesmaids or the new Ghostbusters. They say, well, can women really be funny? Glenn Headley was great in this movie and funny and fantastic. If you get a chance to see it, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, 1988. You mentioned to me there was another obituary, sort of a local one.
Right. I just want to mention Herman Silverman, who just died. He was age 97.
Wow.
And he was actually the founder of Sylvan Pools, which is a big pool company, which he and his brother founded in the 50s. Yeah.
Yeah.
And sold in 1969. He went on to do a lot of real estate. And he was a great benefactor in terms of various charitable and public efforts in this area. So he's a big name. He, in fact, John Michener founded the Michener Museum.
James Michener,
right. Sorry.
Okay.
Among other things, a great local museum here that has a wonderful Nakashima room and lots of Bucks County artists and interesting exhibitions, and also founded the Artmobile, which is a mobile exhibition space that is run by the Bucks County Community College, where I got my start under Fran Orlando in terms of working as a...
an art teacher.
Well, not an art teacher, but interpreter of the exhibitions that are there. And he was a guy with a lot of ambitious ideas, and he ends up doing a lot of, you know, making a lot of money in real estate after he sells the pool business. And one of his fun ideas that never came to fruition, though, was in the 50s, he and his wife went to Florence and they saw the Ponte Vecchio, that old bridge with the shops on it. And he said, we could do that between Lambertville and New Hope. And he actually proposes, he comes up with the whole plans, proposes that to the powers that be. And there's always, well, what do you do about parking, etc. He comes up with strategies for that. And it never actually happens. But it was a fun and interesting idea. I mean, here's a guy with a lot of successes, but many failures as well, which brings us to
the Museum of Failure. That's the big event that that took place also while we were away, which opened in Sweden. That's right, the Museum of Failure, which features in particular products which did not succeed; they failed. Products like Bic pens, made especially for women.
The Lady Bic.
The Lady Bic. Coca-Cola Black, a coffee-inspired drink. And it goes, oh, yes. And, of course, what is that? A Harley Davidson fragrance. Something that smells like Harley Davidson.
Does it smell like the Harley? Does it smell like the guy who rides the Harley?
It's a for a certain kind of person, that's an attractive aroma. It didn't succeed.
Apparently.
The purpose of the museum, Dr. West, who runs the museum, says, is to show that innovation requires failure. He always thought this was a good idea. But he didn't know that a museum was necessarily going to work until he ran across the Museum of Broken Relationships. Once he saw that, he said, I decided I had to get busy with my museum of failure.
So what's the definition of a failure, a product that fails?
It's not clearly defined. I think it's whatever they can get their hands on. But he does make the point that everyone's obsessively focused on success, but 80 to 90% of innovations actually fail. And so his question is, why don't these failures get the attention they actually deserve?
But these are products that
didn't live up to their potential.
Like the Segway. The Segway was supposed to transform transportation.
That's right. They fell short of expectations.
Right. And in the end, it's just a cute little thing. And actually, it reminded me of a book I read just a couple of years ago called Being Wrong by Catherine Schultz. Mm-hmm. And it was a really good book about the, you know, we're so obsessed with being right all the time. And yet it's our mistakes, our errors that often teach us the most and allow us to move forward and come up with perhaps even greater innovations.
Right. Yeah, so we'll have to get to the Museum of Failure when they actually get it going.
So I can recommend that book, Being Wrong.
Being
by Catherine Schultz.
Frank DeFord passed away. Frank DeFord was one of the...
You've got to tell me about him because...
You don't know who Frank DeFord is?
Well, I sort of do, but actually...
He went to Princeton.
Actually,
he's a big Princeton alum.
I understand, but I've only been hearing his commentaries on the public radio for the past few years.
All right.
And he was kind of cranky.
All right. He's cranky. He died at the age of 78. He was cranky anyway. He did, as Tamsin said, do commentaries on NPR, but he's been doing them since 1980. But that's not why he's a figure, honestly. He's a figure because he wrote for Sports Illustrated for 30 years. And more to the point, he was one of the first writers for Sports Illustrated. What Sports Illustrated did, and it started, as Tamsin likes to say, as everything else started in 1954, he got in a few years after that, honestly. But Sports Illustrated put together a roster of writers such as Dan Jenkins and Roy Blount and Mark Cram and others, later Rick Thielander, later Rick Riley. They were into writing. Sports Illustrated was about sports to some degree, but they were into writing. There was a great tradition of great writing for sports. And they wrote substantial pieces, not quite New Yorker length, but pretty long, in-depth pieces. And Frank DeFord was on the forefront of that kind of thing, and it was really well-written stuff. And you don't see that anymore, quite honestly. And what DeFord was quoted as saying, and I guess a book that was written just a few years ago, is how he was decrying how sports media had changed. He said he mourned the loss of what he saw as deeper storytelling in favor of X's and O's and gossip. He said, I believe that the one thing that's largely gone out is what made sports such fertile literary territory. The characters, the tales, the humor, the pain. That's what those articles were about. And you had a lot of sports writers who crossed over into novelists. I could go on, but the best example is Pete Hamill. Pete Hamill became a fairly substantial author, fiction writer. But he was a sport. I grew up reading the sports in the New York Post. Pete Hamill was the main sports writer, and there were others of that ilk. And that kind of sports writing is something you just don't see anymore.
I'm just not sure how you draw the line, where you draw the line between human interest and the story and the gossip.
Well, it's not a matter of drawing lines. It's a matter of distinguishing between what's gossip and what's real storytelling and what's real reporting. Gossip is just, you know, this person's in trouble because of that reason, or this person did something that's controversial. That's what I would call gossip. But what sports is really about, sports is about challenges. And the people who are at the center of sports, whether it be success or failure, are meeting or facing the most substantial challenges going. And why do they put themselves in that position? How are they going to deal with that challenge? How are they galvanizing themselves? How do they react to failure? How do they react to success? What's their real story as people? And that's something that you don't get so much. It might seem obvious to you, but you don't get it anymore. I know you see in the Olympics, the up close and personal, this stuff, but that stuff is highly superficial. That stuff is there. Isn't it great? This person had this challenge. They worked it out.
Howard Cosell was not.
Okay. You mentioned Howard Cosell.
Yeah.
Howard Cosell. Howard Cosell was.
Part of that? Or
he was part of that.
Okay.
So Howard Cosell, as long as you mentioned it.
Sometimes people just describe him as a buffoon.
They do. But here is Howard Cosell. For those of you that don't know, Howard Cosell was a highly controversial, difficult sportscaster. Journalist, as he would call himself, sports journalist in the 60s, 70s, 80s. And I happen to have in front of me, by coincidence, a piece by Frank DeFord about Howard Cosell. And this will give you a sense of Frank's writing and also a sense of Howard Cosell. Quickness and momentum. You take the whole last generation of sports, listening to sportscasters, watching the games, analyzing, arguing, instant replay, second guessing, and all you'll get from the broadcasts are words like quickness and momentum. In the booth, only one man possesses quickness and momentum, and that is Howard Cosell. In a throwaway business, he survives. In the most imitative of businesses, he hasn't met his match. He, let alone, been surpassed. When others say he's but a parody of himself, there's even a measure of compliment in that. One thinks then of Nureyev, who once said, "I may get tired of playing Romeo, but Romeo doesn't get tired of having me play him." Just so Cosell never tires of having Cosell play him. That's the comparison between Cosell and Nureyev, and that's DeFord writing about a dancer at the same time he's writing about Howard Cosell. Anyway, great writer, and you don't see that kind of thing very much anymore.
Well, we got to wrap this up.
Well,
we got a busy night tonight.
Well, tonight
we got to watch the Tonys.
We have to watch the Tonys, and I'm going to slip something in that Tams is going to cut me short, but I'll do it really fast. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal that says, headline, "Take a night off, bet. These theater goers prefer understudies." Bet obviously being Bette Midler. And the story is...
there are people who follow understudies.
Who understudies, because people follow everything. And it's on social media. They track the understudies. They communicate with each other. And they say, so-and-so, in this case, a woman named Robin Herder is pictured here, is going on. You have to see her in this. And
so people know about this because of Facebook and things like that.
Exactly.
There are ways of indicating, yeah, I'm on tonight.
Right. So whereas most people are disturbed that they're going to see the understudy, not the main character, this cult group follows the understudies. But what's funny to me is the headline is "Take the Night Off, Bet." And you read the article, and it's not about Bette Midler and Hello, Dolly, because there's been no understudy work in Hello, Dolly. And yet that's the headline they choose, "Take the Night Off, Bette." And what's the subtext? The subtext is
they're begging her to take the night off.
They are. If you'll recall, we talked about this before. The Wall Street Journal gave a highly negative review about Bette Midler and Hello, Dolly, and she's about to have an understudy.
Let's not rub that in.
I don't want to rub it in. I just want to say this. The understudy is Donna Murphy, okay? We will see how that works, but just so it's clear, Donna Murphy, who is Donna Murphy? Donna Murphy is a great Broadway actress. I will just do this. I'll read one sentence from a review from Wonderful Town, 2003 New York Times, about Donna Murphy, quote, "On your knees, citizens of Broadway, a superwoman walks among you, Donna Murphy."
Okay.
All right. We'll see how that works out. But let's.
It's almost like you're a shill for Donna Murphy.
No, not a shill for Donna Murphy, but we'll see how that goes.
Let me put it this way.
Let me just say one thing. I would rather see Donna Murphy open a refrigerator than see Bette Midler warble her way through Hello, Dolly. But to go back to Italy, let's close on that since that's the big event.
You know, the thing about these trips is, and we ride through the countryside, and we see wonderful things. We see amazing cathedrals, frescoes, vistas. But it's also the little things. The little things. That when you're riding through the countryside, you get to see, you know, just spontaneous little vignettes.
Yeah.
And here's one of my favorites from this trip. And we're off in the middle of who knows where. We go by a school. And it looks like it's recess or something. There are all these kids out in the schoolyard.
No, I remember this.
And there was kind of a big oval track.
Right.
And all these children on bicycles, a little electric cars, pedal cars, and they're all going around the track. And there was an older gentleman in a uniform kind of directing them. It seemed to be some kind of traffic school for elementary children in their little vehicles. And it was absolutely just charming.
Yeah.
And it's now, moments like that that really, I think, make the trip.
You see a lot on the bicycles, and you get a great experience. And look, just seeing the scenery, just seeing the surroundings, seeing the small towns, going to the little cafes, going to the bars, it's a great way to travel.
And we had a great time. So we will see you next week.
On Tamsin Dan Read the Paper.
Goodbye.